Accession number 17731, Reel 5.
Mr. Mark, Reel 5.
Thank you. There was something I think I might have left out or not finished due to my stay at Portobello. Is one night a lance corporal come into the hut where I was alone, and he looked at me and he said something like this, that I'd had a rough time, I got my chin on the ground, this, that and the other, like everybody else there. And he said, has it never occurred to you that everybody in charge here and the staff are lance corporals? And I thought to myself, so they are. I'd never thought of that. And I grunted out, yeah, I suppose so, something like that. He said, well, I'll tell you that my rank is higher than yours. I never knew quite what it was, but I don't doubt him for one moment. His rank was higher than mine. He said, it is the law here that we are shown as lance corporals. If we can rattle you, upset you, you hit me, you hit one of the other lance corporals, you kick them about. He said, we report all these things. He said, it goes against you. They're looking into your character, your stress problem, whether you can, your caliber, he said, for the job you've been looking for. He told me, and he said, if you ever repeat this conversation between you and I, they'd sack me, get rid of me. So he said, I'll give you one, a word of advice. From now on, keep your mouth shut, your eyes and ears open, and you'll go a long way. And with that, he faded into the night.
So, really, this place was nothing to do with the fact that in your particular individual case, you wanted to stay in the army. And
they were just sorting out people who were low-graded into something they could do. And it happened that this time I fitted into that Red Cross slot. I carried my regimental, a cap badge. I was never a medical corps man. I carried a Red Cross card, which I got upstairs.
How do you think they knew by then that you could work with women?
I don't know. I've no idea. No idea. How did I know I was the officer type? I'd never had that sort of education.
How do you feel now about having served in the Second World War?
Grateful. I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I'm heavily pensioned for my wounds. I'm pensioned on other things. No, I'm glad I didn't miss it. You see, my service with the Queen's ended really and truly on August the 1st, 1941, when I got hit with that mortar. It blew the gun at us. Did the lot.
But how do you feel about having missed further active service in the war?
I would have been happy to have gone to the desert, because that's where they went. That's where Captain Salmon was killed, and a good many more. Most of them were taken prisoner at El Alamein, in that Quatre Depression, the salt flats there. I know about that. But I never saw it. And, of course, I never saw D-Day. I was at Bournemouth when D-Day was. The night before, the whole bay there was covered in ships, landing craft. The next morning it had gone.
Do you feel any sense of resentment today about having served in the Second World War towards anybody?
Resentment? No. No, I don't. Damn it all. England's England, isn't it? I'm English. You see, people call me a Brit. I've had that said when we were on holiday abroad. A Brit? You're a Brit. I'm not a Brit. I'm a bloody Englishman. A Welshman's a Welshman. A Scotchman's a Scotchman. We're all Brits together. When we're combined, I'm an individual. I'm an Englishman. I'm born in England. And Churchill's my old bud. And in that 1945 election, I went from Tring. I was at Tring. I went from Tring to Wood something, wasn't it? Where that was his constituency. And I heard that brilliant man say, I have to tell you, he said, that we must have a pool of unemployment after the war to stay solvent. And I couldn't forgive him for that. But that's what he did say in that speech. And there was no unemployment because that Labour government got it. Full employment, wasn't it? No, I don't regret any. Damn it all, I'd have picked up a gun here if they'd have come. I would have murdered, mate, if I could have got my way. My dad had a rough time with them Germans in the First War. I'm bitter.
But why did you admire Churchill so much?
I thought he was a man for the job. And if I could have been in his shoes, I'd have done the same things if I'd have had his power.
But who did you vote for in the 45 election?
Labour. Like I all did. Labour landslide. Even the officer type was fed up with it all.
Could I ask you one final thing about, in general, about something that people often say to me about these recordings? They often say to me, how do you know that what they're telling you is true?
Yeah.
What do you feel about the reliability of what you've told me?
Well, I'll say this right away. Since I spoke to you over the phone, I have thought a lot because I have stressed to Tony, my son, who I think you must have been in contact with somewhere along the line, that I had to be accurate. And memory over 50 or 60 years is a problem. And I said that to my wife. I must prepare myself to try to be accurate. And that's what I've done. Take it for what it's worth. I'm an honest guy. I've tried.
But do you think your memory is reliable?
I suppose it's a lot reliable as any other sane man. It can be. At my age, I'm 78.
Now, there are one or two things that you've been telling me off the record that we haven't put on tape that I'd like you to put on tape, please, for the record. One is about an incident at Armentières during the retreat to Dunkirk.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that story of a French woman?
Yeah, I will. Vivid in my mind. I've committed her to my God. I mean that. She must be there somewhere.
Can you tell me the story?
Yes.
Now?
Now?
Yep.
As I've been asked to tell you this, of which I omitted to tell you of something I thought was too small to be mentioned before, I will tell you now of an incident that happened, quite honestly, as left in my memory, indelibly left in my memory, of the lovely old French woman, grey-haired, 75 in those days, she must have been just outside of Armentières prior to it being obliterated by bombers in 1940. We were retreating in chaos, partially marching, partially running. And she came alongside me from nowhere, dressed as an old lady, in a black dress, pleated at the bottom, typical French woman, spoke pidgin English, 75 years of age, or at least. And she said to me, drink this. And I looked at her, and she had French cubes sugar, which is slightly a different shape than British, and a jug of hot water and a mug, into which she put the cube, put in the hot water, twirled it round and told me it would keep me going. I'd already been told and ordered not to accept anything from any civilian, case they poisoned us. We fifth column, this sort of thing. But in desperation, she said to me, take it, son. I did it for your father in the First World War. On her breast, she had a little flag, little paper flag, a Union Jack, and she gave it to me, and I drank it, and she moved farther down the line as they overtook her, doing the same thing. That little old lady was one of the best of the French that I ever met, and I committed her many years ago to my God to take care of her and give her the pair of wings that she so deserved. That's that little story.
Did she say that to you in English?
In English. I'd done it for your father in the First World War. And she meant that.
There's another thing that I'd like you to record that you told me off the record about your attempt to contact a relative of one of the men who was killed during the accident on the 1st of August 1941.
That's right. Now?
Please.
Another incident I remember absolutely clear in my later life, this is, during my working life, towards the end of my working life, I had suddenly got an urge and I'd got to know that a great friend of mine, my actual number two of my mortar gun, the accident that blew away so many people, four of them all together, and left me alive and partially crippled, and this particular friend killed. And I knew he came from a town or a village called Horsell, just outside of Woke in Surrey. And after all these years, it came back to me that I would like to visit his grave. I knew he had been removed from Margate. I didn't know by whom or why, but evidently his parents claimed him and they wanted him in their local church yard. And I knew that. And then all these years later, I convinced a commercial manager from my company to take me to Horsell. And we had difficulty in finding the grave. And the local vicar came out and told us and helped us to find it. Went with us to the grave and then left it. And we examined the grave. And around the edge of the grave, edging to the grave on a stonework was the word something like this, given to him from his comrades in the 1st 5th Battalion, the Queen's Royal Regiment. That was the surround and a little grave, and it was terribly overgrown everywhere around it. But this grave was attended. It had a row of, say, three or four clumps of small bedding begonias, and they were in bloom, and it was a lovely summer's evening, and we left. Later on, I had a typist type a little note for me and put it in a plastic envelope, which could be seen through. And the same week, I took that little note back and placed it on that grave, giving my address and the reason for me putting it there. But I never heard I never had a phone call, never had a letter. And time went by. And then I thought another way I could get in contact with the family, if they're still alive. We're talking of 50 years later of the accident, which happened in August the 1st, 1941, at 4:30 in the afternoon. 50 years later. I look into the telephone directory and there are several people in that area by that name. And I eventually ring several of them and they didn't know what I was talking about. Very polite, very nice. And eventually I made another phone call and a man spoke to me and said he was a member of the family and he knew about this young man and how he got killed and everything. But his sister would like to meet a phone or get in contact at a later date. So I asked what was convenient, got the gen, and eventually in an evening I phoned. And I'm afraid my phone call was not accepted too well. She didn't want to know. She said to me, "Why is it after all these years that you have never contacted us? What have you got in line now?" And I tried to tell her that her relative had died with me and I had lived. And he was a great friend of mine. We used to go and leave together. We were known in the regiment as so-and-so and so-and-so, the twins. And she said, "I don't want to know and I don't want you to contact me anymore." And she put the phone down. It nearly broke my heart. It was a different story that my friend had told me, although I knew that he come from, shall we say, a family that could be and always were a little tiny bit John Blunt. End of story.
Tiny little bit what?
John Blunt. She was John Blunt to me. By God, she was. She didn't... I was a criminal for phoning.
What relation was she?
To him?
Yeah.
I don't know. The other fella said my sister. I don't know whether it was an aunt. I don't know. She was uncouth. It just shows you how difficult you've got to be in contacting people.